Warm welcome to this session of the Windows Azure Camp. In this session, we're going to be covering getting started with Windows Azure. My name is Jonathan Rosenblatt. I'm a developer advisor here at Microsoft Canada. All of my contact information is there on the screen for you. Feel free to connect in whatever network works for you. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that have to do with Windows Azure, cloud computing in general, or if you have any other questions about any of the Microsoft Developer Platform technologies, feel free to connect with me as well. In today's session, we're going to be covering three different objectives. The first of which, we're going to answer the question, what is Windows Azure? Then we'll look at how to get started building applications for Windows Azure. And then last but not least, we'll make sure to cover some of the key concepts of the platform that you need to know in order to get started. So with that, let's get started. So, what is Windows Azure? Think about Windows Azure as a developer platform where you can build and deploy applications to an infrastructure that you don't have to spend any time configuring, procuring, installing, or anything like that. It's just there available for you. And actually, out of the box, you get all of these different features like scalability, availability, and geographic distribution simply by deploying your application right onto the platform. On top of that, you actually have the ability to manage the entire platform through various different easy-to-use interfaces like your Visual Studio Suite or a management portal that's available to you online. We'll get into that in a little bit later. And then last but not least, it's a platform that basically gives you various different building blocks that you can put together to build applications and access functionality without actually having to code it yourself. And as we go through the session and also other Azure Camp sessions, you'll actually see that more and more. So when we talk about key benefits for the platform, really it does come back to that layer of abstraction, right? You don't have to worry about procuring and configuring and installing all of the infrastructure that is underneath. More importantly, you don't have to worry about monitoring it to make sure that you've connected everything right, configuring firewalls, load balancers, so on and so forth. It actually puts that layer of abstraction in there for you so that as a developer, you could just worry about building your applications and then deploying them into the platform. Everything else is taken care of for you. As I mentioned before, just out of the box, you have scalability and availability and geographic distribution. And you're going to hear me saying that throughout the entire Azure Camp sessions because that's truly where the benefit is. For a developer, the last thing that you have to worry about, or rather the last thing that you want to worry about, is actually having to go through all of these infrastructure pieces. As your solutions need the demand or need the scale, you can simply go into a management portal and say, you know what, give me additional instances. Or when you don't need it anymore, you can actually take those down. Or when we're talking about availability, you can say, well, you know, I don't want to worry about whether my application is up at all times. With the platform, the Windows Azure platform, you can actually basically outsource all of that worries to Microsoft so that we can make sure that your applications are highly available. The other key benefit of the platform is that you can actually mix and match services. A lot of people say to me, well, you know, if I move to the Windows Azure platform, I have to go all in. I have to put everything up in the cloud. And the truth of the matter is that that's actually not true. What you could do is you can mix and match services both from what you use of the platform, so you don't have to use everything of the platform, but more importantly, it's a platform on your terms, which basically means that whatever it makes sense for your solution to be hosted on-premise, then you could do that on-premise. Whatever you want in the cloud can go in the cloud, and there are technologies in the platform that allow you to connect the two together very easily and without having to worry about too many network configurations in the process. Right, so when I say mix and match services, you can look at it both from that perspective of going on-premise and in the cloud, but also of the services themselves that are on the platform, you don't have to use all of them. You actually just use the ones that you need for your solution. The other nice benefit that a lot of businesses are worried about is the fact that with the Windows Azure platform, you actually just basically pay for what you use, but more importantly, you pay for what you use when you use it. So unlike other platforms, or when you actually have to buy infrastructure for your on-premise infrastructure, you actually have to buy that up front. Whereas on the platform here, you basically build out the infrastructure that you need when you need it, and that's when you actually get started getting charged. So there are no upfront charges for you to worry about. It's just when you actually start using the service. The other very important benefit of the platform is that Windows Azure, from day one, or version one, I should say, was actually built to be open and interoperable. Well, what does that mean? It means that the platform can actually support multiple different technologies so that you can build the solutions in whatever you feel comfortable building in. So a lot of people say, well, you know what, Windows Azure is a Microsoft product, and therefore it only supports .NET. The truth is that, again, with Windows Azure being open and interoperable, that's actually not true. Out of the box, Windows Azure supports the .NET framework, Java, PHP, Ruby, Python, and you can actually make additional languages work with just a little bit of additional tweaking. Now, the nice thing about being open and interoperable as well is that all of the services on the Windows Azure platform are all standards-based services, which means that even the tools that are available for each one actually allow you to build with the tools that you're comfortable building. So let's say on the .NET framework, you're used to working with Visual Studio, and then you can work with Visual Studio. If you're used to working with Eclipse, you can work with Eclipse. That is the true meaning of being open and interoperable, really allowing you to do what you need to do in the way that you like to do it. Just to give you an idea of what's available for the different platforms, for .NET, you do have the SDK, and you also have the Visual Studio tools that give you a very rich experience working with Windows Azure. The nice thing is that that's also available for Java with now a plugin that's available for Eclipse. The other platforms, so PHP and Ruby, have their SDKs, and you can actually, through the SDK that comes with it, or the tools that come with it, you can actually get those to work with your authoring tools as well. Another nice thing about being open and interoperable is that there's support for some of the mobile platforms that are out there, like iOS and Android, simply by downloading those toolkits and starting to work with those ready-made objects. So, you know, you start getting this idea of, well, you know what, it's not just .NET, and you can work with whatever you feel most comfortable in. For more information, actually, on all of the open and interoperable projects that are going on, and as well as the ones that are available for Windows Azure, you can actually go to interoperabilitybridges.com, and you have all of the various different projects there, links, downloads, and so on and so forth. So make sure you check that one out. Now, when it comes to scenarios of where you would use Windows Azure, there are ones that are actually specifically, or say ideal, types of applications for Windows Azure, and those ones are really where you do need that scalability, the availability, fault tolerance, and geographic distribution. Some of the common scenarios, and we're actually going to be talking about that a little bit later, there's a session specifically on application scenarios, but just to give you a highlight, common scenarios include websites, right? So think about an e-commerce site, or think about a business site where you have a lot of demand coming in and there's a lot of load on the servers. So with a website deployed to Windows Azure, you can actually then go in and scale up your website or your web solution to whatever you need it to be to meet that load, and then scale it down when it's no longer necessary. Right? And the idea being, again, is that you're only paying for what you're using when you're using it. So during those times where you need that additional load, then you add those instances in. You pay for those. When you get rid of them, then you stop paying for those. And that works out really well from a cost-effective perspective. The next scenario is compute-intensive applications. And that really talks to applications that are running algorithms or equations or anything that really requires a lot of horsepower. A very good example of this one is video encoding, for example. So you can actually install a video encoder on one of these instances, and we'll talk about instances a little bit later, so don't worry if you don't necessarily know what that term means. But the idea is that if you install your video encoder there, then you can actually use the pure horsepower of that server to go ahead and encode your video. Another one is if you're running mathematical equations or batch processing of transactions, data manipulation, so on and so forth. I mean, there's plenty of different options when it comes to applications that really need that computing power. Let's talk about device applications. Now, we used to call this mobile applications, but these days, many, many more devices are actually becoming internet aware or online aware. You have things like fridges that can actually connect online. You have Blu-ray players, DVRs, and basically any device that can make out an HTTP or an HTTPS request, you can use Windows Azure as a backend to host all of the additional functionality that you want to offer up to those devices. So think about it when it comes to outsourcing power, computing power, that is. So rather than doing things on the device itself, you can actually move that up into the cloud, get the cloud to do that for you, and then send back the results to the device. We're thinking about it from a storage perspective, right? Usually devices have a finite amount of storage that you can use. So by leveraging Windows Azure for your storage needs, you could then basically open it up to an unlimited amount of data for your device application. Like I said, we're going to go through that in a whole lot of details, so make sure to stay tuned for that session. When we talk about web APIs, very similar to websites, those are basically APIs that you're hosting for all the various different clients or devices or anything like that that others are creating to be able to connect into your API. And again, you need to worry about the scalability, the availability, and the geographic distribution, especially when you are providing APIs to someone else. They are counting on you to make sure that you're there and can meet their demand. So you want to make sure that the infrastructure is there to be able to support that for you. Last but not least, social gaming. Now this one has been around for quite some time when it comes to, let's say, Xbox consoles or PlayStation 3 or whatever, and games that are allowing you to interact with people and voice and all that kind of stuff. But really where it's sort of becoming newer these days is this concept of the connected experience across the devices. So it's not so much anymore where it's just, you know, Xbox to Xbox, let's say. It can actually be Xbox to phone to desktop, and so you need the infrastructure in the back end to be able to connect all of these in real time. And so that's where, again, with the Windows Azure platform, allows you to spin up as much as you need based on the load that you have on your game, and then spin it down when you don't need to anymore. Plus also all of the additional features of the platform, remember those plug-and-play services that I was talking about earlier, those really give you all those added benefits to your game that allow you to get the game done and into market a lot faster, and then be able to start making money off of it or profiting off that without having to worry about coding all of that yourself and then having to worry about the infrastructure to be able to support it. Like I said, more on scenarios in the application scenarios session of the Windows Azure Camp. All right, so let's talk about what actually the platform is. And when you look at it, at the bare bottom, you have the three core services that make up the platform. The compute service is basically where your horsepower is. Those are the virtual machines that actually host your code and actually then run your code. On the storage side, you have services like blob storage, table storage, and queue storage that allow you to work with data, storing them in ways that are very performant, very scalable, and again, geographically distributed so that your application doesn't have to worry about where it's putting its data. You just make service calls into these particular services. And because they are services of the platform, all of the scalability and availability and the geographic distribution is actually handled for you. So that's actually a really nice thing when it comes to really making sure that you're focusing on just your application. You don't have to worry about all of these additional things. More specifically, in blob storage, you're going to put all your large files. So your videos, your pictures, documents, or really any type of file that you need very quick access to. Your table storage is really where you're going to put data that you need to get to very fast. Non-relational data or flat data is really what would go in there, and you can query that and get back the results. Again, all service-based. So you're making out calls to a REST-based service, or if you're using one of the SDKs, so the .NET and PHP and all those guys, they actually have objects that are ready for you to use, very similar to the ones that are actually in the framework itself for you to be able to access those services. On the database side, you have SQL Azure, and that's really the Windows Azure equivalent of SQL Server. Now, the nice thing about that is that because it is like SQL Server, there's a lot of symmetry between the two of them, so that if you know how to use SQL Server and you have your databases already stored in SQL Server, it makes it very easy to then transition them over into SQL Azure and actually also from SQL Azure back into SQL Server if you need to. Now, there are a couple of caveats and there are a couple of differences between the two, which again we're going to go through in the Understanding SQL Azure session of the Azure Camp. But for all intents and purposes, think about this as your version of SQL Server that's hosted up in Windows Azure, where again, the scalability, availability, and the geographic distribution is taken care of for you. When we look at packaging the deployment, now this works for basically all of the different platforms. It basically always comes down to a service definition, a service configuration, your code that gets put together into one item called a service package, which then actually then gets deployed into the compute service. Now, depending on what you have for compute, which we're going to go through shortly, then it'll either spin up a worker role or a web role and then host your application there. Let's dig deeper into that. A service is basically the starting point or the container of everything in your Azure world. And that includes the definition of what your infrastructure is going to look like for your application. And it includes also the roles, and we'll talk about those in a second, but basically the different machine types that you need in order to support your infrastructure and your application. All of that is basically packaged together. The service has a URL that you can access, especially if it's a web application. You're going to set up something, you know, something.cloudapp.net. And that actually shows you that that's hosted in the Windows Azure data centers. Now, you can map your own domain name to that simply by adding a CNAME record in your own DNS for your domain and pointing it to that something.cloudapp.net, which then allows it to make sure that it's dynamic, so if you know IP addresses change and whatnot, then your domain name is always pointing to the right Windows Azure service. Start talking about roles, you know, and the roles is basically what defines the virtual machine that will host your code. And then the instances of that is really how many times your code in that virtual machine is copied and deployed. So basically, you're going to start with a minimum of one, though the recommendation is actually start with a minimum of two instances so that we, on our end, can ensure that you have the high availability. You know, if you only have one instance, when the instance needs to be upgraded, patches, or let's say it becomes unstable for some reason and Windows Azure tries to recover it, during that time, if you only have the one instance, your application might actually be inaccessible. What happens when you have two instances is actually, or I should say two or more instances, it's actually the load balancers in the Windows Azure data center will make sure that the request coming in from your users is going to whatever instance is up and ready to receive. So when it comes to upgrades and such, that actually allows one instance to be worked on while the other one is up. And then when the patches or upgrades or reboots and stuff like that are done on the one, that one comes back up and then the second one goes down. Same thing there, patches, upgrades, and everything like that, and then it comes back up. All at the same time, because you have those multiple instances, your users are being redirected to whatever is up, and so they don't notice anything happening in your backend. So I started talking about role types, so let's actually go through them. There's two role types in the Windows Azure platform, the first of which is the worker role, and then we have the web role. The worker role is really, think about it as a server where you can install various different applications into, or your actual application itself, and really think about it in terms of background processing, or really anything that doesn't require a graphical user interface. Granted, you could enable remote desktop to get into the worker role, but it's not meant for applications that you're actively using. It's really meant for things that you can access on a command line, or Windows services, or third-party applications like web servers, mail servers, encoders, so on and so forth. And really, it allows you to really use the computing power of that virtual machine to process whatever you need. A web role, on the other hand, is a similar type of virtual machine in that it is a Windows server, but the addition here is that you actually have IIS installed. You have all of the different services that are required to run ASP.NET, WCF, PHP, so on and so forth. And actually, one of the main differences between the two is actually a web role has access to, or I should say from the internet, using HTTP or HTTPS by default. The worker role wouldn't have that. You can enable TCP connectivity on the worker role, but with the web role, you have HTTP and HTTPS. And really, again, it's really meant for websites or web APIs or anything like that, that it is accessible through HTTP and HTTPS calls. So let's look at the actual architecture itself. Starting from the top, coming in from the internet, like I said, either via TCP or HTTP, first thing that you do when you hit the Azure data centers is actually you're looking at the load balancers. Now the load balancers will look at, okay, where does this request need to go? Where does that something.cloudapp.net actually, you know, resolve to? And then it's going to send you there. Now if you're having multiple instances of whatever role you're running, again, that's where the load balancers make sure that you're being redirected to whatever is available. The more instances that you have, the more the load balancer can spread the requests across, thereby allowing you, of course, to have that much more load in your application. Now you'll notice storage there in the middle has its own load balancer, because that is actually services that are available to you from the platform that you can then leverage in your applications. So those in and of themselves are load balanced and therefore scalable, available, and geographically distributed outside of your applications. So remember we were talking about before mixing and matching, right? That's actually where this comes in handy, because you can actually access storage directly from either a phone or a device or an application that's not hosted in Azure, and you still get the benefits of that scalability and that geographic distribution. So let's talk about the instance and the sizes. And remember, I said the instances are really those copies of the virtual machine that hosts your code. Now you have a whole bunch of various different sizes, and each one gives you various different CPU, memory, local storage, I/O performance specifications, depending on what you need. Now, here's the trick with these guys. The one tip that I always give everyone is don't just throw big virtual machines at every problem. Doesn't necessarily make sense. In the Azure world, rather than scaling up, which means that you continuously make the same server faster, beefier, more cores, and so on and so forth, you actually have the ability to scale out, which means that you can use smaller instances and more of them to pretty much achieve the same thing and, of course, potentially be a lot more cost effective. You know your architecture best for your application, so you'll know what makes more sense, but really my recommendation is try the different sizes out to see what works best for you. Don't start with the largest and go from there. Really start from the smallest and go from there, and you know, through your load testing and your performance testing, you'll see what makes most sense. There are some instances, say like, you know, if you have a specific video encoder or you have some specific process that doesn't really lend itself well to parallel processing, then yeah, you're going to go for a larger instance, and that makes sense at that point. Okay? So just consider the fact that with the Azure platform, really you want to target scaling out versus scaling up. Let's talk about the service definition and the configuration. Remember, those are the files that I was mentioning earlier that get together with your code into that service package. And in that service definition is really where you define the type of operating system that you want. So whether it's Windows Server 2008 SP2 or it's 2008 R2, you get to specify that. In the service definition as well, in the configuration, you get to put in all of the additional configuration and items that you'd like to have. And really the point there is that typically you're used to putting your configuration in web.config or app.config. The one thing you have to keep in mind is that you don't really have easy access to either one of those files. What happens when your service package gets created your code plus the service definition is basically put together into that package. It's encrypted so that when it's being deployed, either through Visual Studio or through the management portal, nothing gets in the way of basically tampering with your code or anything like that from when you deploy it from your machine to Windows Azure. So what ends up happening is that those files are part of that encrypted package, and you don't have access to them. Well, luckily, with the service configuration, you can actually put the variables that you need easy access to, things like connection strings or anything like that. You can put those in the service configuration, which sits outside of that package, and then that way you have easy access to make whatever changes you need. And the nice thing is, of course, that that affects all the instances at once, as opposed to having to worry about going into each file and modifying it for each one of your instances. The other thing that you can define as part of the service definition is the endpoints that are available for your application. You can define the HTTP or HTTPS endpoints. You can define what port you'd like it to work on, the different protocols that you can connect to. Again, allowing you to customize that environment for whatever your solution requires. So if you need your application to work on port 81, let's say, instead of 80, you can do that by defining that endpoint in your service definition. Last but not least, one of the things that you can also do is create what's called startup tasks. And those are basically additional instructions that you can provide the virtual machine in order to do when it boots up. So that includes both right after it's provisioned or every time that it needs to recycle, anything like that. And really what you're going to put in these is actual instructions for the server that it needs every time it comes up. So things like, the example there is installing PHP, if you need that. Or if you need to initialize something on the server or make a configuration change, or install additional things from Web API. Different things like that you can include in a startup task so that without having to access the machine, you can get the machine to configure itself each and every time, which makes it very easy for you when you need to scale up, or like I said before, if Azure detects that one of your instances has become unstable, it can actually just make sure that it spins up another one and all of your settings and your configuration and all is replicated over there as well. Let's talk about deployment. Each hosted service that we mentioned, or each deployment, basically has two areas where you can deploy to: staging and production. Think about staging as a temporary location where you're going to put up your application, and you can do all of your last bit of testing. Okay, that includes your end of your user acceptance testing, load testing, performance testing, so on and so forth. All of those last tests right before you go into production. Now, your application in staging is available to people and has a very long and convoluted URL that really has a GUID.cloudapp.net. And those that you share that URL with, they'll have access to that application. But for the most part, unless you give out that URL, no one's really going to be able to find your application, which really allows you to do all the necessary tests that you need to do. The production environment is really what is available to everyone and is accessible at that, whatever you set up, .cloudapp.net. When we talk about deployments, you can actually do deployments in multiple different ways. The first of which is you can do that through the Windows Azure Platform Portal. Now that one's really used, that one's done through a browser, it's a Silverlight application, and really used for when you need in organizations that need to show sort of separation of duties, a developer will create that package and will hand it off to the infrastructure folk that then can actually do the deployment through the platform portal. Now granted, as a developer you could do that as well, but really for the developer it's actually a lot easier if you have access to do it through Visual Studio. Because right from Visual Studio there is a publishing wizard that will actually walk you through all of the different steps that are needed to get your application to package it up and to send it up to Windows Azure. So it's up to you really on what you use. If you really wanted to, you can also use the REST-based management service APIs that are available and create your own deployment application. Or, last but not least, there's also PowerShell commandlets that you can actually use. And those work especially well for automated builds. You can actually script the deployment so that your build server can take care of deploying your application into staging for you. The idea there, again, being that you have the option to deploy wherever it is that you like and whatever makes sense for your environment, and the platform gives you the ability to do that. So from a data center perspective, when you're actually going to deploy your application, one of the first things that it asks you is what data center you want to deploy to. And that's really where it goes back to what I was saying before about geographic distribution. There are 6 data centers across 3 different continents in the world, North America, Europe, and Asia Pacific, and you have the ability to deploy to any one of those. Or really, because you would consider spinning up multiple instances, you actually have the ability to deploy to multiple data centers. And the idea there is really you want to locate your application where it's closest to your users. So if the majority of your users are in North America, then you would deploy your solution into one of the 2 North American data centers. But if you had a significant amount of customers or users that are also coming from the Europe region, you might want to consider having one both in North America for the North American users and one in Europe for the European users. The nice thing is with that is that because your application is now located close to them, then they're not having to travel all the way back to North America in order to get your content, which of course then leads itself to additional performance and latency gains, or I should say reduction of latency, because it's actually physically located that much closer to them. So different things for you to consider as you're working out your architecture to now think about it instead of deploying to the one data center because your traditional type of on-premise or standard hosting type of solution had only one place to go. Now you actually can do that across the world where it makes sense for you to do that for your users. Now, upgrading your application is yet another one of those things that you have to consider as you're working with the platform. And again, the Azure platform really makes it easy to do that because you have 2 options for upgrading an application that you already have a production version of. So, in the case of the first one, you have a production application already. You can deploy your new version into the staging environment, and remember, no one really has access to that unless you share the URL with them, and basically, you can do all your tests there. When you're ready, through the management portal, there is a nice button that's called a VIP swap, a virtual IP swap, and what that does is it actually then swaps what you have in staging and puts that into production, and then it takes what you have in production, puts that back into staging. Basically just means that it switches your current production version with the new one and just puts that in production for you. The other option is an in-place upgrade where really it allows you to, rather than having the 2 running side by side, it actually just puts it on top of the one service. Now, different types of scenarios or different type of applications will render themselves better to either one of these. Best recommendation there again is to try out whatever makes sense for your application. Give it a try, try one, try the other, and then you'll actually see based on whatever changes you're making as part of the version upgrade, you'll see that one lends itself better than the other. Now, can't talk about the Azure platform without talking about the additional building block services that I mentioned at the beginning, different services that you can use to put together your application, one of which is caching. This one is really giving you a very robust and very performant way of caching data outside of your application so that especially if you're working with multiple instances or you want to store session state and stuff like that where you don't want to send it to the instance. Now there's many reasons why you don't want to do that, one of which is the fact that those instances are actually stateless. So when those instances reboot or you're doing an upgrade or anything like that, it's going to go back to what you have in the code. Or in the case of caching, it's actually going to clear the cache. So really what you're looking for is sort of an out-of-process caching mechanism that allows you to very easily read and write data without having to worry about saving it to the actual instance. And that's actually where the caching service comes in. Really, really fast stuff. And the nice thing is that of the objects that are included in the SDKs and such, you actually already have all the building blocks that are required to basically tap into the caching service. But if you don't want to use those objects, that's perfectly fine as well. Caching, again, because it's a service, very much so like the Azure, the other Azure services are all REST-based services, and you can go ahead and access it directly through the, making HTTP or HTTPS calls. Access control is one of those other services that is actually quite heavily used in many applications, because what it allows you to do is outsource authentication and authorization from your application. So, no longer do you have to worry about creating those login screens and maintaining passwords and having to worry about the security of that data, so on and so forth. Here, with, again, just service calls back and forth to access control, you can actually now tap into Windows Live, Facebook, Yahoo, Google, all of those to actually, through configuration, be available to your application for authentication and authorization. Once you built that into your application, in that call to access control, then your application is redirected to one of these providers. You do, they handle the authentication, and it actually sends back the token to your application and says, yes, you know what, this is this person and this is who they are. Makes it very easy for you to integrate with all of those providers without having to go and code each one. More importantly, this is one of those services where, again, you can use it on your own, on its own from a device or anything like that, simply to build it into that application running on the device to handle all of those additional things that, again, you would have otherwise had to code into your application. The other key benefit of the access control is, especially for you that are looking to build applications that tie into your on-premise Active Directory infrastructure, using Active Directory Federation services, you can actually have access control peek into your infrastructure to look up user information there without having to replicate your entire AD infrastructure into the cloud. So if you're looking to build single sign-on type of applications or applications that are going to use that Active Directory presence that you already have, access control with Active Directory Federation services allows you to merge the two together so that you're not replicating additional users. Very easy to manage. You're actually just managing the one forest, and that's it. Service bus is a very nice way, again, service-based, to allow you to put data onto the service bus and be able to pick it up from whatever other endpoint you're looking to connect to. This works really well if you have loosely coupled apps in your solution that you want them to communicate with each other, but there isn't that natural fit for them to communicate. Actually, this works very well for enabling hybrid applications between your on-premise infrastructure and your cloud applications without having to open up any firewalls or any ports and anything like that. On your on-premise solution, you basically just make an HTTPS call and put the data onto the service bus. And then on the other side, you do the same. You're using the service bus as that intermediary to basically control that data so that you don't have to worry about making the two applications connect to each other. Very, very useful stuff, again, for loosely coupled applications that you want to tie in together. When we look at data services that are available up in Windows Azure, first thing that comes up is the SQL Azure reporting services. And that's really the ability for those of you that are used to working with reporting services on-premise, the ability to do the exact same with your SQL Azure databases. Again, very much so like on-premise reporting services, you're going to create your reports in Visual Studio, deploy them the exact same way that you would have deployed your applications to Windows Azure. And then the rest of it, the interaction or the integration into your applications, is literally the exact same. So it allows you to do all of that kind of reporting on data without having to bring the data onto your on-premise infrastructure just for those reporting capabilities. DataSync is actually one of the newer services on the platform that allows you to synchronize both from your on-premise SQL Server to your SQL Azure database and then back, or from a single SQL Azure database to another Azure database if you have them in different data centers. Now, the nice thing about this is that there's no code that's actually required. It's all configuration-based from the platform portal that actually allows you to discover those databases, decide what you want to sync, decide how you want to sync, and then the rest is all scheduled and done for you. So really, really good stuff if you're building on-premise and, I should say hybrid, on-premise and cloud solutions, and you need that data to go back and forth, or if you're building solutions that use those multiple SQL Azure databases, and you want to synchronize those without having to write any additional code. So in summary, we went through all the various different types of the different aspects of the platform. We talked about service definition, configuration, and the packages and how those work together to get your application up into Azure. We talked about roles and the worker roles and the web roles and how those split out into instances, having one or more instances to actually run your application. Basically there, the more instances you have, the more load your application can actually take on. Talked about the different computer instance sizes and how you should look at deciding what size is the best for your particular solution. Then we touched on how Azure is designed to be open and interoperable, allowing you to use the various different platforms, .NET, Java, PHP, Python, Ruby, and whatever other platforms you want to configure yourself so that you don't have to specifically change the way that you're building applications just to be able to put them up in the cloud. Talking about the various different scenarios, and again, for this particular one, there's a session specifically on just different scenarios, so check out that one. And then we talked about all the rest of the building blocks that are available to you on the platform, the data services as well, that you could use to mix and match and put together your solutions. Now, with the Azure Camps, you have hands-on labs that are available for each one of the sessions that we go through. For this particular one, you can go to bit.ly/AzureCampGettingStarted. That's this session. You'll have the hands-on labs there, and you'll also get all the information on how to post questions about this particular session and how to get in touch with me in order to have those answered, or as well to have them answered by various different people who are working on Windows Azure solutions. Check out these additional Windows Azure Camp sessions at bit.ly/AzureCamps.